This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking about food this week with respect to communities of color and the ways that systemic racism has a hand in shaping what we eat, how we eat it, and how we get what we eat. Did you know that fewer than 2% of America's farmers are Black? That's a pretty staggering statistic under any circumstances, but maybe especially in light of Black people's enslavement as the cornerstone of America's agricultural economy and the subsequent history of Black sharecroppers. Today, we've invited two farmers who've made their mark in agriculture for their stories and for some ideas about change. Barbara James Norman is a fourth-generation blueberry farmer in Covert, on the west side of Michigan. And just to note, as you're listening, that we had some problems with our internet connection. You probably hear some glitches through the course of the interview. All the same, Barbara, very glad to have you. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, and it's good to be here.
We're also talking with Malik Yakini. He's the executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and also one of the leaders responsible for D-Town Farm. That's a 7-acre organic operation in Rouge Park. Malik, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start out by asking you both, we're in this moment when a growing number of people find themselves at home, find themselves with some time on their hands. And, you know, maybe they've been headed outside into the backyard. And I don't mean to compare what you two do, you know, full-time farm work is not the same as a backyard grow, but what do you think it is that attracts people so much to growing right now? Malik, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. So I'll start by saying that I both grow at D-Town Farm, and also this year, primarily because of the pandemic and having more time at home, I'm doing more in my family garden. And it's very therapeutic, first of all. Let's start with that. You know, you're outside, you're getting fresh air, you're getting sunlight, all of which are essential for good health. But also, on a deeper level, most indigenous cultures understand that the earth is alive. The earth is not just the third stone from the sun. And there's energies that are emitted from the earth that we really need contact with for us to be whole and healthy. You know, this is an old understanding, but now in modern times, people are calling this grounding. You know, when people go outside with no shoes on or stand on the earth. And there's been a lot of evidence that even for things like attention deficit disorder, that children spending time outside on the earth helps to remedy the ADD. So connecting with the earth is absolutely essential. And there's something, I think there's some primordial urge that we have that leads us to connect with the earth in various ways, which is why people like doing things like camping and picnics and things like that, where we get a chance to, for those of us who are city dwellers, to kind of come out of buildings and concrete and reconnect with the natural world.
For sure. Barbara, again, I know there's a vast difference between a working farm and the backyard grow, but what comes to your mind when you hear and see people talking about their own grows at home?
The differences aren't that much difference when you get down to it, it's because it's all about producing food. And the old saying, you are what you eat. So it's no difference than with what Malik does in Detroit within the soil than what I do in COVID in the soil, only maybe the size. And I think it's so important now because people want to know where their food comes from. People are getting away from the chemicals. And I grew up knowing that if your soil is perfectly balanced or right, if you got to have good soil health, you need good body health, and all that comes from growing food and eating good and healthy. And I can do the same thing. I can grow lettuce on a porch in Detroit or in a backyard garden in Minnesota. You can feed Detroit with the soil right there in Detroit. And because I don't personally believe in food deserts, only to the extent that people haven't come back to what they really naturally should do and grow their own food.
Barbara, I wanted to ask, how's the blueberry crop this year?
A little different. It's one of the years that maybe people will kind of, with the fruit and all of it, because of the weather or different things, it wasn't as bountiful as some years. And it wasn't as long as some years. A lot of crops are fields are already finished.
Yeah.
But I don't complain when it's not a bumper crop. I use what I have and be thankful.
Barbara, you're the fourth generation in your family to run the farm. Can you tell us a little bit about how your family came to live in Covert?
We're celebrating our 75th year on this land.
My
grandparents were from Mississippi, and my grandfather was the first of nine sons, a total of 12 siblings altogether, to move to come to Chicago with an uncle. But when it came time to move my great-grandparents up here, he couldn't do the city. He needed someplace. So they started traveling in the summers just for my great-grandfather to have someplace to do fruits and stuff. And so they leased this land for several years before purchasing it in August of 1945.
Wow. Barbara, I know you grew up on the farm and were surrounded by this life from a very young age. Malik, you grew up in Detroit. Would the young Malik Yakini ever thought of farming as a career that he would pursue?
No, it never crossed my mind. And you know, one of the reasons is because farming is not really valued in society. So rarely do you hear parents saying to their child, "Johnny, I want you to grow up and be a farmer." So I think, you know, we were steered away from things like that, you know, particularly in urban areas. But even with that, as I look at what I'm doing now, the seeds of this were planted as I was a child. And my first exposure to gardening was actually in my grandfather's backyard, who had come up from Georgia in the early 1920s. And, you know, most folks from the South, you know, as Barbara just talked about, agriculture was part of their culture and they wanted to keep that as part of what they did on a day-to-day basis. So my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, always had a garden in his backyard. And I used to spend time in that garden as a young child with him. And I'm sure that planted the seeds that have sprouted in what I'm doing now with gardening and farming.
How did you become interested in doing this work as an adult?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1960s and kind of 60s and 70s. And was radicalized as a young person in Detroit. 1969 was 2 years after the Detroit Rebellion. And so this kind of very rebellious spirit was still in Detroit. And I was fortunate to go to a school, post-junior high school, where I had teachers who exposed us to Malcolm X records, the speeches of Malcolm X, and had us reading Black Panther Party newspapers. And so it really politicized me at an early age. And so I've always been interested in Black people being able to be more self-reliant, being less dependent upon others, and having more power to control our own destiny. So for many years, I was involved in other aspects of Black community empowerment. And, you know, it became apparent to me that food is a necessary part of that. We can't have freedom if we're not able to feed ourselves. You know, initially, my interest in food was on a personal level. I'm a vegan and have been for 40 years or so. And so I was very interested in how food impacted my personal health. But then later I began to understand how it fits into the whole social, political, economic realm. And for the last 20, 25 years or so, I've been pretty deeply involved in agriculture.
Malik, what would you say? How have you seen farming work as a tool for change in people's lives, maybe moving them closer to a place of social justice?
One of the things I've seen is that farming actually produces results. Many of the other kinds of activities I've been involved in as an activist, we go to dozens and dozens of meetings, and then sometimes you can put the results of those dozens of meetings in a teaspoon. But
right.
with farming and gardening, generally there's some relationship between the amount of effort you put into it and what you get out of it. You get some tangible outcomes. And so that's tremendously motivating for people. You know, like for children, if they plant carrot seeds, and they can stick with it for, you know, 3 months and see that seed that they planted grow into an actual carrot, it's transforming because they begin to understand something about their own power and how when we meld our own power with the miraculous power of nature, we can produce these results.
Malik, could you say a little bit about the topic of food sovereignty? I mean, maybe first of all, just explain what it is and whether that is a goal that you work with people to actually achieve. I mean, anybody who's even dabbled in backyard gardening knows, you know, how much work it can be. Is that a goal that you try to encourage people to reach for?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, although our organization is called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, we realized fairly early on that what we're really working towards is food sovereignty. And the difference in food security and food sovereignty is that food security at the most basic level is just making sure communities have enough food to eat, which is important. But as a friend of mine, Raj Patel, said, you can have food security in prison. You can be in prison and have enough food to eat. So obviously we're struggling for something more than that. So what we're interested in is how do we have control over the system that provides our food? You know, in Detroit, for example, Detroit is probably the blackest city in the United States with at least an 80% African-American population, but there's not one African-American owned grocery store. And so, you know, 600 some thousand black people in the city of Detroit are dependent upon people of other ethnicities who come into our community and set up what they call grocery stores and what I call wealth extraction stations to suck millions and millions of dollars out of our community. And if we were able to capture those millions of dollars we're spending on food, we could circulate that money to create the institutions and the infrastructure that we need in our community to have healthy, resilient communities. So we're interested in the whole process, not just making sure people have enough food in their stomach. We're interested in making sure that we're controlling the whole food system and we're benefiting from the tremendous amount of money that is spent on food.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Malik Yakini with the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and also D-Town Farm. And we're also speaking with Barbara James Norman, a fourth-generation farmer in Covert. Barbara, we know that 98% of farms across the United States are owned by white families. That's a pretty astonishing number. What is it like to farm today in an industry that is so overwhelmingly white?
I love it. I love it. I love it for different reasons. Not because I think that the playing field is level. I know that it's not. And just like the difference in big town Detroit, small town Covert, you're talking a town where there's no red lights, no railroad tracks, no tall buildings. But you're talking a town that's never been segregated. So it's different, but there are some similarities.
So we heard you talk about Covert and how, you know, it's really a different kind of small town community than a lot of other places are. What's the larger context when you're moving outside of your hometown in the context of the larger farm economy?
It's amazing because I can relate and I've done it. I found barriers are kind of similar, be you black, white, Indian, polka dot. Barriers are barriers. And so we have to change as the times change. And that's the difference of being from this little small town. Anywhere in the country that I go, I have similarities. I can relate. So you just got to do the work, like Malik said, and you've got to grow healthy food. If I'm in my backyard and putting Roundup and chemicals on everything, I'm going to get the same results if I'm a giant farmer and putting Roundup on my whole crop. It's all about good, healthy food and having what you want to eat and what you need to eat and being in charge of it. You know, my grandfather always taught me that he who owns the land makes the rules.
Makes the rules.
Right. And then he taught me when he used the word farmer, he says, a farmer, baby, we get the first count. We get the best of everything. We get the first ripe tomato. We get the first apple. So I was taught these lessons. And when you're in the soil working, it's a soothing, it's a feeling. I got the lessons, didn't know that I would be afforded this opportunity to apply them to people across the country or anywhere I go and meet a lot of friends who are interested in being in charge of their body. And now that is growing because people are more interested in what's going in their body. They're not counting on the big Walmarts or the Myers or the Tyson people to give me food for my body.
Right. I have a question that I'd like to put to either of you who might have some thoughts about it. What do you see as some of the biggest barriers to more black people entering farming? And what might it take to bring more folks into the industry? Barbara, would you like to start that one?
Okay, I have it in a nutshell. lack of knowledge. We're not aware of the agriculture world. We're not aware of how profitable it is financially, spiritually, health-wise. It's all because we don't know. Knowledge is the same as whether I can read or write. If I have the right knowledge about agriculture, then I can be successful and more people will go into it.
Malik Yakini, anything to add there?
Yeah, well, I agree with Barbara that, you know, one of the big shifts that needs to take place is kind of a cultural shift, which would include our knowledge about farming and all the things she just mentioned, but also kind of how we view farming. Because for Black people in particular, many of us still have this stigma about farming because we associate it with slavery, with our enslavement. And so I've had many experiences working with young people where we have them at our farm or in a garden, and within the first 15, 20 minutes of them working, they make some reference to slavery. I've had similar experiences with young people who grew up in the Caribbean. So many Black folks in the Western Hemisphere associate farming with enslavement.
Is that disheartening to you, Malik?
Is it disheartening? Well, I mean, it's the reality that we're faced with. So I'm not disheartened by it. I just know the work that we have to do to shift that around. And also, there's a culture shift that needs to be made in American society in general. As I mentioned earlier, very few parents, you know, tell their children, I want you to grow up and be a farmer, because people don't value farming in the same way that they value these white collar professions, although the whole society is dependent upon farmers. But also there's issues about land ownership. There's been historical discrimination in terms of Black people buying land, a Black land loss that's continuing to this day, Black farms being foreclosed on. We have the whole history of the USDA discrimination in lending. And so we have this whole historical legacy of advantage that white farmers have had that Black farmers have not had because of unfair lending practices. Financing continues to be an issue for Black people, not just in farming, but in every area of society, because wealth is concentrated in the hands of white people. And anytime Black people go to try to get financing for something, it's always much more difficult to get it. There's been discrimination in terms of seeds, having access to seeds. Sometimes folks haven't even been able to buy seeds from certain companies. There's problems with the markets, with who you sell to. There's the problems of scale. Some markets only want to buy on a certain scale that's very hard for farmers to produce at, for smaller farmers to produce at. So there's multiple impediments that that Black farmers have. But none of these things should stop us from doing it. And if we work collectively, we can overcome all those problems.
Malik, a lot of people are aware that Detroit has more open land than a lot of other cities we could talk about. How hard is it for people who want to turn that land into food production to actually get it?
There's still quite a bit of difficulty with that. The city of Detroit has a program where if there's a vacant lot next to a house that you own and your taxes are paid up to date, that you can buy the vacant lot next to your house, I think, for $200. But that counts out renters. It counts out people whose taxes are not up to date, which is a huge segment of the Detroit population. The other thing, the city has a program where they'll let people use lots to do growing on, but the agreement is only for 1 year. And so you have to get that agreement renewed each year. And the thing about farming is, as Barbara said, the most important thing is the soil. And so if you develop the soil, you put all kind of organic matter in it and compost, then you don't want to have to move after a year or two, because this development of the soil is a multi-year process. So there's been some advancement in Detroit in terms of the elected and appointed officials understanding how urban farming fits into the whole kind of planning of what the city can be. But there's still a lot of confusion, still a lack of transparency, still kind of an uneven application of the policies. I want to mention, though, that our organization, along with Keep Growing Detroit and the Oakland Avenue Farm, just recently launched the Detroit Black Farmer Land Fund, where we've raised something like $60,000 so far to help Black farmers in Detroit purchase land either that they're farming on currently or that they would like to farm on.
Both of you spend a lot of time helping other people who want to farm. I'd like to ask both of you as we wrap this up, what maybe the most important lesson is that you can impart to a young farmer right now. Barbara, would you start us out?
Yes. Owning land, keeping some land, don't sell your land, and the importance of land. You've got to, just like the culture change, it starts at the root. Sometimes we want to wait, we want to start somewhere the person is not. You've got to teach them the value of the land, teach them what to do with the land, and just make it be important, but you've got to do it in a way that it means something to them. Teach them about agriculture. Teach them to grow something. Let them grow one thing. I would start with just that educational piece of the culture and about nature.
It's so interesting to hear you say how important it is to hold on to the land. I know that that's a concern that a lot of white farmers grapple with these days as they see the creep of suburbia. And, you know, trying to make good decisions for their family about whether or not they should stay in the game or whether they should sell. I can only imagine those pressures are twice as hard for Black farmers to navigate.
Well, if you remember my opening statement, barriers are the same. Maybe they squeeze us a little harder, but that's because we've been the Black culture has such a strength to them. And, you know, I look at all the things with people coming over, the Hispanics or the Germans or whatever. We were the only ones that came back for us. We wasn't allowed to decide, oh, there's an America over there we want to go. We are survivors. We are strugglers. And you have to instill that pride in people of color, too. This would have been my seventh year for 100 Detroit students coming here every year to do berries and have an ag day. But I had a kid here 2 years ago, was a junior in high school. And he says, you know, I've saw him on the roadside dead and in pictures, but he wanted to see a live deer walking through the path in the woods made him think of that. And so things like that, you've got to expose people and children.
Malik, what would you say if a young farmer was looking for you know, one big takeaway to show them through this?
So it's always difficult for me to answer when people ask about, you know, what is the one thing?
There's not one thing, yeah.
But one of the things that I think is really important is that we live in a culture where people are used to things being instant and people have short attention spans, you know, everything is in small sound bites. People are living in the short term. And farming really is a long-term commitment. So, you know, changing our mindset from this culture of instant things happening to beginning to think in years and decades is the advice that I would give to new farmers.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us today. It's great to hear your voices and everything you have to say and that you're both doing well. We've been speaking with Malik Yakini of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and D-Town Farm, and also with Barbara James Norman from Covert, Michigan. Barbara, Malik, thank you so much, and please do take care.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all.